In the past few weeks, the security atmosphere has become tense as a result of a series of security breaches and incidents in the capital, Abuja, particularly the Kuje jailbreak and attacks on soldiers attached to the elite Presidential Guards Brigade. Hello, welcome to The Crisis Room, a podcast from Human Angle. I am Maryam Mustafa. In this podcast, we look at crisis trends across the country. Today, my colleague Murtala Abdullahi and I are with Chidi Nwonu, a security expert. We will be looking at what's happening in Abuja.
So good afternoon, Chidi.
Good afternoon, Chidi.
Welcome for the Crisis Room.
Hi, good afternoon. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, so you're joining us from where?
I'm currently in London.
Well, nice. I hope it's sunny over there.
It is actually sunny. Let me not jinx. This has been the sunniest I've ever had it in the UK. So I'm enjoying myself. It's good.
That's actually nice. Over here, it's Abuja, it's a bit cloudy because it's rainy season.
No, we're enjoying our summer, although that means there's no rain. So we're not having any rain at all. It's just pure sunlight. So in fact, our grass is dry, our rivers are running dry. But that all ties into, you know, some of the issues that, you know, we kind of touch on about climate change and the effects that is happening all over the world.
Yeah, exactly. A lot of people are now beginning to see the real impact of climate change, especially with intensity in terms of temperatures over there. And in Nigeria, as Leah mentioned, it's cloudy here and it's kind of reflect the security situation in the country, especially in the capital, Abuja. So basically, our conversation today is around what's happening in Abuja. And some few days back, I remember seeing your Twitter thread about some of the trajectory in terms of the trend. And so, yeah, you have a military and security background. You have also studied security trend and the insurgency in Nigeria. What else do you want to tell us a bit about your background before we start the conversation?
I think you've covered it quite well. I mean, I've been in the British Army as an Army Reservist for almost 20 years now, moving up all the way from private soldier to officer, serving in Iraq and Afghanistan. So I've had practical experience maybe at the lowest levels of this kind of counterinsurgency fight, but also now as an officer, you know, working in the staff at the headquarters. I've also had the experience of the higher levels of the planning, of the thinking that goes into all these kind of things. And obviously, as a Nigerian, I've, you know, tried to apply some of what I've learned or what I've seen to what we have back home, and maybe not do what I think many analysts do and just try and cut and paste. You know, try and get an understanding of what are the peculiarities of our own problems. How do the things that have happened elsewhere inform them and the potential solutions, and also, you know, look at what we're doing right and what we're doing wrong and kind of find out what's the middle ground.
Yeah, actually, so I love three things that you said, especially the two P's, in terms of our peculiarities and also your experience around planning, and then how do we learn from our lessons and also the stuff that we've done wrong and ensure that we do the right things. So generally, I would like to get your assessment of what's happening around Abuja. What do you think is happening, and where do you think the trajectory is heading towards?
So I think the Abuja problem set is very interesting. It's very interesting because you can see something is happening, but you're just not quite sure what it is. But you know, as I mentioned in the tweet, everything is flowing what to me, for my own kind of viewpoint, looks like a fairly structured plan. So we can talk about it from the operational point of view, from what I believe we are seeing, which is, you know, as I mentioned, that there are five stages. Now, those stages will not be chronological. They will not always follow one after the other, but they are broadly, you know, for the purpose of, you know, discussing our presentation, I put them in a chronological order. So I said, you know, obviously there's a preparation of the battle space. So I would define the battle space to be the area of the Federal Capital Territory and the surrounding states. Then the second stage that I considered was the second phase will be the shaping of the battle space. So by shaping, you mean creating conditions whereby the whoever it is, the insurgents or the adversaries, can undertake certain actions, you know, to them for their benefit, being military or otherwise, and then also isolating the battle space. So again, in this circumstance, the battle space now shrinks to the Abuja metropolis itself, and you know, the surrounding areas. And then the fourth stage would be the attack, which maybe it might be a little bit more controversial, because I don't believe we're going to have a big set piece attack against Abuja. I believe we're just going to have a series of attacks, low level attacks that that you won't even be clear.
So by low level, do you mean the kind of, for example, the attack that we saw on the Gaji Brigade checkpoint around Zumarok, or the Kujie jailbreak, and then the other one in terms of the attack on members of the Gaji Brigade also around Bari?
That's exactly what I mean. So in this case, when I say the attack, what I should actually maybe expand that to say the attacking phase, maybe something like that, where you will see a series of attacks that's, you know, are degrading, you know, friendly forces, that are causing casualties, causing losses. But it's not, as I said, it's not going to be a big step. It's not going to be like trying, like Baga or Bama or Gozal, you know, trying to overtake the city. I could be wrong, but I don't see that as a logical conclusion. But what I see is a series of a death of 1,000 cuts that will, you know, slowly bring everything down to, you know, shrink everything down into the center. And then the final phase being the exploitation, which, as I said, doesn't mean that at the end of everything they will do an exploitation phase, but exploitation means benefiting from what they've done. So in terms of money, in terms of weapons, in terms of publicity, in terms of recruiting, in terms of, you know, kind of having a strategic effect on the state. So when we talk about preparation of the battle space, you know, what I believe that, you know, we've had this conversation, you know, a while back, you know, about what we're seeing moving in around, not, you know, I mean, in those days, it wasn't in Abuja itself, but in the states surrounding Abuja, the amount of activity, the amount of the presence of, you know, non-state actors, you know, not maybe in those days, maybe not necessarily violent, but they were there. They were proselytizing, they were recruiting, they were in the bush, they were just there. And I remember, you know, back, you know, those a few years back when I was having, you know, a series of conversations, you know, the question is, what were these guys doing? Why are they there? Are they just resting? Are they going to rest there and then go back? Or are they building a structure, building a presence?
So when you look at the outskirts of Abuja, over the years, there's been high intensity in level of violence, whether in terms of major highways being inaccessible, whether in terms of the Kaduna-Abuja or the Abuja-Okene Road. And then you also have a lot of security situations happening on the outskirts. Maybe people are not paying attention. So if I get correctly, we should not just assume things are just happening in isolation or stuff just happened suddenly. There was a trajectory before we got to where we are today.
Definitely, definitely. So, you know, we've traveled, like I've traveled that road, the Okene Road, and I've traveled the Kaduna Abuja Road. And I mean, you know, even a few years back, it was a little bit moody, but it was not like what it is now, where, you know, it's like life and death.
That's actually accurate. It's not just happening in isolation. We have tracked these trends, especially the vulnerable roads. We've seen violent attacks in Kogi and Suleja, and these attacks were claimed by ISWAP. They involved attacks on security forces and IEDUs. Would you say there's a difference in the nature of threats to the capital now?
Definitely. Definitely. And these were the warning signs that, you know, many of us were shouting about, you know, those years back or those months back, and that the nature of the conflict has changed. And that's where I believe they went into the shaping phase. So when they moved from the preparation phase, which was just being there, you know, where we were getting reports of flags flying, whatever it is, but they went to the shaping phase, which was the actual attacks, the use of IEDs. That's a big combat indicator. You know, that's not something the average bandit is going to use. That's a definitive, you know, weapon of war. And that was clearly before the to use a generic phrase, before the enemy would, you know, show their hand to start using IEDs, start using mass attacks, start using proper kind of tactics, you know, ambushing large formations, things like that. It means they're ready. It means they now want to do something. And what they were doing was, as I said, shaping the battle space. They were creating the conditions whereby security forces now are on alert. They were unable to move freely. They have to, you know, devote a lot of their time to force protection, protecting themselves, their bases, their convoys. They are not able to protect the populace. They are not able to engage in offensive operations. And that shuts down the ability of the security forces to actually see what's happening, to understand, you know, what's going on around them.
Yeah, so you actually mentioned something that I was going heading into in terms of security forces. So what's clear from our conversation is that there was a trajectory and security forces should have really seen it happening. The smokes were really clear. And so something happened. The system was not either not built to prepare itself for this kind of scenario, or there were failures that allowed this situation to get to where it is now. So in your thought, what do you think would be the kind of accurate response? So for example, we have seen checkpoints being set up in response to some of these attacks. However, my opinion is that some of these checkpoints could actually be disastrous in terms of the fact that you're having hundreds of civilian vehicles choked up in one checkpoint, and you're probably not doing accurate checks. And people who want to do this kind of attack, they usually find irregular routes to move in and move out. So what do you think should be the kind of recalibration in terms of both the intelligence, the kinetic or the non-kinetic interventions?
So as I said, I believe we're in the attack phase now, so the enemy is going to be attacking. Now, how do we deal with this? I'm going to try and not talk too much in detail, but maybe give a little bit of detail. So how will I put this? I'm trying to think of how to phrase this delicately. We're already kind of at a bad stage, going to be a brutal fight. But the key thing is to defend the city, keep them out of the city. And the only way you can keep them out of the city is to attack. Now, how do we do that? How do we take the fight to the enemy to force them to fight on our terms, you know, at a time that we choose, in a location that we choose? You know, as you said, the checkpoints, all we're doing is creating bottlenecks for ourselves. We're restricting our own mobility and giving them a target-rich environment. You can set up, as you said, you set up a checkpoint, you're checking vehicles. All I do is I go to the end of that checkpoint and start robbing people, kidnapping people, shooting people. By the time you respond, we have a firefight, a few more civilians are killed. I've had an effect. I've humiliated the military, I've, you know, gained some hostages, whatever it is. So the point is to push this fight outside the city. And the only way to do that is, again, the point we've been emphasizing for many, many years is through, you know, offensive action and with masses of troops. We have a big obsession with, we want to buy Tucanos, helicopters. These are all great weapon systems. It's troops on the ground. I'll give an analogy. One of the great counterinsurgency campaigns that people always study is the British campaign in Malaya. Now, there's many reasons why this campaign was successful. But what's interesting and important for us now is that they had many of their troops were always on patrol in the jungle. But the key thing is that most of those troops never actually spotted the enemy or never even fired a shot at them. And because they frustrated the enemy. The enemy wasn't able to now concentrate their troops because they were spending too much time avoiding the British patrols. If they did engage the British patrols, they got into a fight that wasn't on their terms because there were so many British patrols around. Once they engaged one, another one was coming from another angle. So the point is you dominate that battle space. So the same way the enemy prepares the battle space and, you know, isolates it, you reverse that and you dominate it. And the only way to do it is to flood the area of the FCT with troops. Push them out into the bush, take control of the key terrain. So the high ground, there's lots of hills, there's lots of dead patches of forest. It's very, you know, from a military point of view, it's a very interesting battle because, you know, the terrain supports the insurgent, but it also supports the counterinsurgent because you have a lot of terrain there that you know the enemy has to pass through. You know that if you control this hill, they either need to come and take that hill off you because you can see what they're doing, or they have to find somewhere else. So it's just, you know, it's by understanding the terrain and taking control of it, you then push the insurgents out and then they're forced to fight the battle on your terms. Again, it won't be easy. It won't be, you know, it won't be like a video game or a film.
Absolutely. I don't think it's going to be easy. Yeah. So what's clear is that, yes, you need to secure the FCT, but you also need to address the broader insecurity across the country or else the capital will continue to be threatened. Is that something that you think it's...
Defending the capital means you're pushing the problem away from the capital, which means it goes back into Niger State, it goes back to Nasarawa, into Kaduna. So you, at the same time as you're pushing them out, you have to have a holistic plan to secure those areas. And
So you have to secure the areas. So in more broader terms, you need to also secure the exterior also, and just the country entirely.
Yeah, you have to, because once you secure Niger State, now where will they move? Maybe they'll move south, maybe they'll move east, maybe they'll move north. Who knows where they'll go? So you have to have a holistic plan to secure the entire country. But if your main effort, which unfortunately for this, simply because of the prestige of the country and everything, is defending Abuja, you might win the Battle of Abuja by, you know, scattering them and pushing them away, but they'll just go back, regroup in Kaduna and Niger State and Nasarawa and come back again.
Wow, quite interesting. So it's not how much money you invest in buying those heavy equipment. It also has to do with basic things like having a more efficient ground force. And so how do you, so one last question, how do you balance between not having sufficient boots on ground and having a large terrain to cover? And so do you think that technology can also be a force multiplier to fill in some of the gaps due to the insufficient boots on ground?
Yeah, definitely. Technology is a beautiful force multiplier, but you need a force to multiply. That's the key component that we keep seem to be missing out. You know, there's no point having a UAV that can spot the enemy if you don't have anything to respond to. So you can be like, all you'll be doing is watching a TV show. Oh, I can see them attacking. Okay, send some boys. We don't have any boys. So you need a force to multiply. If not, you're just wasting your time. It's the same, like we can see now with the Ukraine-Russia conflict now, you can see how UAVs are being used. They're not just being used to observe the enemy. They're being used to conduct strikes on the enemy. They're being used to call in artillery. So without the UAVs, you'd be, like, for example, using artillery, you'd be going back to old school where a man will be on the ground looking at the artillery, calling it in, putting corrections on his map, calling it back. Now, the people firing the cannon can actually see where their shots are landing and do the direct corrections. And the Ukrainians have now developed an app that automatically does that for them. So that's how you multiply force. You actually have something you're going to multiply. But in the case that you're in a situation where you don't have enough troops and or you're gathering intelligence, exactly as you said, but there's nobody to process it. There's nobody to look at it, to analyze it, come up with a solution and then give it to somebody to action. Then you're just wasting your time. So the key thing is there has to be a large structural reform. Increase the number of troops. And just as important, and troops and police, most importantly, police more just as many, as much as troops. And when you do that, you have to obviously increase the support for them. But also when we look at technology, we look at buying all these sensors, be it UAVs, drones, getting satellite imagery, you have to improve the intelligence cycle so that from the moment you get the information to when it's processed into a usable product has to be cut down to, you know, a very, very short time. And then it has to be something at the end that can use it. You know, there's no point saying, okay, we know they're going to attack the Kaduna Abuja train tomorrow and there's no troops in the area that can do anything for it. Or you say, okay, we send it to Kano, but what's it to Kano going to do to stop a kidnapping?
Wow.
You know, if you block that train and you get on board the train, all the Tucano will do is fly around and, you know, watch them.
Well, quite an interesting conversation with Chidi. Thank you very much for spending your time with us. We look forward to having you again on the Crisis Room.
Thank you for joining us, Chidi.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Actually, the conversation with Chidi is quite interesting and shows the complexity around what is required in terms of the response by the state. So we need a multi-pronged approach to improve the capacity of security forces and to generally improve security across the country.
This is an episode of Human Angle Crisis Room. Thank you for listening. I am Maryam Mustafa. Join us on the next episode. Members of our production team are Murtala Abdullahi and Anthony Asemuta. The executive producer is Ahmed Salkida.